All right. Greetings and good afternoon, everyone. How's everybody doing? Yeah? Awesome. Glad to hear it. My name is Jeff Woolsey. I'm a Principal Program Manager in the Windows Server and Cloud Division. It's my pleasure to be here to talk to you about Windows Server 2012 Hyper-V. A couple things before I get started. You may have seen some of these in the keynote this morning, but we are honestly quite thrilled to see the reaction from the industry about Server 2012, Hyper-V, but really all of the capabilities and technologies. One of the things I always like to point out to folks is, over in this session, I'm going to barely be able to scratch what's new in Hyper-V. Let me be very clear here. I could spend the rest of the day talking to you about Hyper-V, and we still won't get through all of that's new. This is a major release, and that's just Hyper-V. If you look at storage, if you look at networking, if you look at automation, if you look at PowerShell, if you look at security, if you look at rights management services, I could go on and on and on. This is a huge release. This is a treasure trove release. I kind of think of this honestly as a generational release. This is probably that release that's going to be with us for quite a while because it's going to take a lot of folks time to even understand all of the new capabilities we've delivered in Server 2012. So very excited about this release. One of the things I'd like to point out very quickly is Brad touched on this a little bit today, but I want to be kind of very clear about how we think about the Cloud OS and what is our vision, because it is actually quite unique and different than how other people think about the cloud. For example, when we think about cloud, we really think of it as having, three legs of a stool, three equal parts to the cloud. For example, it all starts with the private cloud, which has basically been an outgrowth of virtualization. Excuse me, I'm just going to get that out of my way. I like to walk and talk. When it comes to private cloud, I kind of think of this as kind of an outgrowth of what happened in the 90s. So in the 90s, I was at a small startup back then. And even back then in a small startup, we were buying servers all the time. And in fact, I'll never forget talking with people through the 90s and into the aughts that would basically say, Jeff, I can buy as many servers as I need. I have as much budget. I can easily justify it. That's not the problem. The problem is I've run out of power to power them with, and I've run out of physical places and where to put these things. So virtualization grew up as an outgrowth of that, and we basically said, look, I got a whole bunch of servers. I'm going to virtualize 5, 10 of these, put them on a single server. Okay? That's virtualization for consolidation. That's great. There's nothing wrong with that. That's not cloud. Okay? Because what happened was when we consolidated, we took a whole bunch of physical servers individually that we used to go log into those and make changes. I'm going to log into the server, I'm going to remote into it, and I'm going to make some changes to how it's configured or to its settings, or maybe I need to give it more memory or change its network configuration, give it more scale, et cetera. But I would log into each one of those machines and treat them as individual entities. When we moved them and virtualized them, the management paradigm never changed. So even though they were in VMs, guess what? We were still logging to each one of those virtual machines and treating them just like physical machines. That's virtualization for consolidation. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. When we think about cloud, it's about, no. We want to think about things any different way. I want to be able to define an application, define its policy, and say, look, at a minimum, you're going to get this amount of memory, this amount of CPU, this amount of storage, and if you need more, it's going to grow. And I will give you an upper cap, an upper limit, or maybe I'll let you go completely unbounded and say, you know what? You can take as much resources as you need. But the point is, I want it to be scalable and elastic. And when I think about private cloud, it's really about control. It's about folks that tell me, hey, you know what, Jeff, I'm running in a Canadian data center, and I've got a workload that's got to run on Canadian soil in a Canadian data center by a Canadian citizen. So it's going to be in my data center. Great. Let's help you build the best private cloud with Windows Server and System Center. At the same time, we know that people are excited about what we're doing in the public cloud. You heard Brad talk about this in the keynote. We're seeing exceptional adoption of Office 365 all over. Office 365 provides our software as a service solution. Azure and our virtual machines give us both platform as a service as well as infrastructure as a service. And when you think about the public cloud, it's really about scale. It's about the fact that, I can write an application today using my MSDN account on Azure, and you know what? Maybe I'm going to deploy it to all of North America. Wow, this works great. Let's make it available to Europe, Asia Pacific. Guess what? It's just part of Azure. Let's just scale this service out. That's scalability. Finally, service providers. Absolutely key and integral because we know that service providers can provide customization as well as unique reach. So you may have a hosting provider that you're already working with. And you know what? You're familiar. You have great terms. You like the customization. Maybe they give you specific things that, you know, you want to run your hardware in your own specific rack, or you want to have some specific requirements you have that a service provider can give you. We want to make sure that when we think about the cloud, it's all of these things. And the reason why this is important, because if you talk to, you know, say a virtualization provider, for example, they may tell you, no, cloud is private cloud. Okay? You go talk to the guys over at VMware, they'll tell you, no, that's cloud. If you go talk to the guys over at Amazon, they'll tell you, no, that's not cloud. Cloud is running VMs up on Amazon. If you talk to Salesforce.com, they'll tell you, no, both those guys are wrong. They'll tell you, cloud is running software as a service. And I'm here to tell you, no, that's a very myopic, very narrow version of the world. It's all of the above. It's the fact that today you may be deploying it on your premises in a private cloud, and maybe that makes sense for a bunch of your workloads, but guess what? Why wouldn't the next time you go deploy a brand new service, why wouldn't you do it on Azure? Because guess what? We can give you global scale if you need it. And guess what? If you decide, you know what, today I'm going to deploy it here, and tomorrow I want to move it there, and I want to move it there, and I want that agility to move wherever business takes me, we want to give you that as well. And that's why we've made key investments in Windows Server and System Center to enable exactly that. So I'll talk to that. So a couple of things I'm going to talk about in today's discussion. Certainly scale, performance, and density. I want to talk about storage investments we've made in file and block. Talk about software-defined networking. Talking about tackling VDI storage challenges, as well as flexible infrastructure. One of the things I've also done is I've peppered my session today with a whole bunch of questions I've heard from you since we've launched Server 2012. I want to make sure I'm answering a whole bunch of those common questions in this session. So there's actually a bunch of new content driven by you. So thank you, by the way, for that input. So let's start with scale-up workloads. So one of the things that you told us, quite simply, was this bottom. I can't stand up. I'm going to be moving around, by the way. We want to virtualize everything. No exceptions. Literally nothing. No stone unturned. You told us, look, I'm already virtualizing my file. I'm already virtualizing my print. I've got a whole bunch of line of business applications already doing that. That's great. Over here, though, Jeff, I've got this big honking SQL server. This thing is using dozens of cores, hundreds of gigabytes of memory. It's attached to my SAN via fiber channel. When can I virtualize that? Because I love the flexibility that virtualization gives me by being able to extract my resources. And I want to be able to do that for everything. So quite simply, that's what you told us. On top of that, I like to point out that scale isn't just more virtual processors. For years, I would have people tell me, when are you going to support 8 virtual processors or more? Because I need to run SQL, and that'll magically fix all my problems. And for years, I've been telling people, no, it won't. I can give you a physical server with 1,000 cores in it. If it only has a gigabyte of memory, who cares? If it only has a single spindle, who cares? If it only has one NIC, again, who cares? Because you're never going to keep that thing busy. Scale is not about virtual processors. It's about balance. That's how you achieve scale and performance. Live migration should just work. Boy, let me tell you something. It's clear that you love live migration. Well, we do too. One of the things you told us over and over again was, don't you dare give me a feature that precludes live migration. I would always ask this question. I have this cool new feature X. If I give you cool new feature X, it means this VM is locked to this piece of hardware. You can't live migrate it. You can't storage migrate it. You can't cluster it. It is literally bound to this piece of hardware. How do you feel about feature X? And the answer was always the same. We want you to shoot feature X. We want you to bury it in the backyard and never talk about it again. Because live migration isn't up for discussion anymore. Live migration is table stakes. We want it always. In fact, we want you to do the opposite. We want you to make it easier than ever to move VMs around. Performance must increase with cores. It almost sounds silly, and I felt silly when I was writing this in the slide, but it's actually very important. Because we could have given you a whole bunch of more virtual processors, but if we didn't do our engineering work, there's actually cases where you can add more virtual processors and your performance plateaus or even goes down. You have to do a bunch of work inside the virtual machine to actually exploit more threads of execution. Finally, again, your big one, we want to virtualize those workloads considered non-virtualizable. And that has a lot of different facets to it. It can be the number of virtual processors, because again, if it was a big old scale-up SQL server, I got lots of cores, I got lots of memory. but I need native access to my fiber channel, and I have to be able to do that without trade-offs. There's a lot of different facets to being able to do that. We heard you loud and clear. So number one, to enable scale-up virtual machines, one of the most important things we have to do is a bunch of work inside the VM. You don't see it. It's actually completely transparent to you. This all just magically happens, though. And it's called guess NUMA. NUMA is non-uniform memory access. This has actually been around since the late 90s, early 2000s. And basically, it's how you group physical processors and memory together so that CPU allocations, thread allocations can happen with the best physical proximity. This gives you the best performance and scale. It was basically, the reason why it came about is as we move to multiple processors, you had processors vying for contention with physical devices. So NUMA came up as a way to solve that problem. And now NUMA is everywhere. It's in your laptop. It's in every device you know to man because we have multiple cores everywhere. Well, to exploit this in a virtual machine, you have to project NUMA inside the virtual machine, which we do automatically for you. Guess NUMA means we actually look at the physical underlying topology and we create an optimal NUMA topology within the VM that's mapped to the physical machine. Now, the good news is this means you don't have to do anything. You want to go and create a virtual machine that's got 4 processors, 8 virtual processors, 16 virtual processors, 32, 48, even 64 virtual processors, we do the right thing. You don't need to go in there. You don't need to tweak any knobs. You don't have to do anything. If you want to, yeah, we put the knobs in there. And in fact, if you go ahead and start tweaking the knobs and make some mistakes, we put a nice big easy button that will reset you back to normal. Okay? Because we found out when we released the beta of Server 2012, everyone thought this was really cool and went tweaking all the knobs. And then they realized, uh-oh, what was the right setting? So we put in a nice big easy button. This is all done automatically. It's policy driven per host. And if you want, you can force your own alignment. But again, you don't need to. We do all the work for you. From a scale standpoint, we literally redefine performance and scale across the board. 64 virtual processors, up to 64 virtual processors in a VM. Up to a terabyte of memory in a virtual machine. And no, we never did memory taxes. On the physical side, we support the largest physical servers on Earth, period. Up to 320 logical processors per server. That's a 16-socket server. Each socket has 10 cores, and you enable symmetric multithreading. That's how you get to 320. We support up to 4 terabytes of physical memory in a server. And I get asked all the time, hey, Jeff, that 320 and that 4 terabyte, are those limits of Hyper-V? Are those limits of Windows Server? No, not at all. Those were simply the biggest machines that are on Earth right now. Give us a bigger machine, give us more memory. I'm happy to put in our test lab, and we'll go even higher. But that's the biggest machine you can get your hands on right now. In terms of live migration, we can now live migrate as many VMs concurrently as you'd like, as much hardware as you bring to the party. In Server 2008 R2, we could live migrate one VM at a time. In 2012, we said, oh, no, we're just going to completely remove the limit. So if you've got a single gigabit Ethernet, yeah, maybe I can do 2, maybe I can do 4 live migrations simultaneously. If I've got dual gigabit, maybe I can do a little bit faster. If I've got 10 gigabit, maybe I can do 10 or even 20 live migrations simultaneously. If I've got dual team 10 gigabit, easily 40, easily 80 live migrations simultaneously. Yes, I said 40 and 80. That's 4 and 8x more than the other guys. If you've got quad team 10 gigabit, we've actually demoed publicly over 200 live migrations happening simultaneously. The point here is we've future-proofed your investment. So today, if you're using gigabit Ethernet, hey, that's fine. That's great. We'll take full advantage of it. Tomorrow, when you upgrade to 10 gigabit, you're set. In fact, what's even better is 40 gigabit is on the runway. 40 gigabit, it's coming to market. And we're already talking about how do we get to 100 and even terabit. So I'm excited out of my mind. And we've already done a ton of optimization to get you there already. Then clusters. We completely blew out cluster scale. 64 nodes and up to 8,000 virtual machines. That's more than twice the other guys. And let me tell you right now, it's really interesting. We had a lot of requests for this. Enterprises, cloud service providers, they were excited out of their mind. They said, look, we want to build these big scale-out clusters for Hyper-V virtualization, and we put a ton of VMs on there. And one of the questions I get asked all the time is, hey, Jeff, it says 64 nodes and 8,000 VMs. Do I have to have 64 nodes? Could I put, 8,000 VMs on, could I put it on a smaller number? Technically, yes. We support up to 1,024 VMs per server, so if you wanted, you could actually run 8,000 VMs on an 8-node cluster. Would I recommend that? No. There's a reason we actually scaled out to 64. Because that number gets so hard, that number of VMs gets so large that you want to disperse it over a larger number of hosts. That's why the 64 node number is actually really important. 64 nodes on 8,000 VMs on 32 nodes, that would actually, even that would be a pretty high fault domain. So that's why the 64 nodes is there. And just in case you're wondering, I wanted to make sure people understand, this is for backwards compatibility as well. I have a number of people that seem to think that Windows Server 2012 is the only one that gets 64 virtual procs, and these, no, that's Windows Server 2008 R2, and in fact, that's Red Hat Linux. And in fact, this one is Windows Server 2008 R2 with 64 virtual procs, a terabyte of memory, running a massive scale-up SQL Server OLTP workload at scale. And to prove it, we've had third parties do some work for us. So ESG went out and tested SQL, and they ran that sucker into the ground. They said, we're going to put the biggest OLTP workloads on there, and what we're going to do is we're going to add more virtual processors to the VM. And the point of this test is really simple. They wanted to show with our NUMA work, our engineering, our development, the scalability of Hyper-V. What you're seeing behind me there is nearly perfectly linear scalability. You're not going to see any platform scale any better than this, by far. After we did our work with SQL, we did our work with Exchange as well. And on a single Exchange server we're running, that's right, 48,000 mailboxes on a single server. Now I want to be very clear. I'm not here to tell you to go run 48,000 mailboxes on a single server. Okay? Come on. HA, you're going to scale that out. My point being, though, is look at the scalability, and we still meet the requirements of Exchange, which is to be below 20 milliseconds. Even at 48,000 users, we were at 15.3 milliseconds on a single server. So let me be very clear. The best way to run SQL Server, the best way to run Exchange, the best way to run Dynamics, the best way to run SharePoint is on Windows Server 2012 with the Microsoft Hypervisor managed by Microsoft System Center. We tune it, we test it, we optimize it, we deliver it, we even build Windows on Hyper-V every single day. Full stop. No one else can say this. So, that's a little bit on CPU and memory. Storage. Wow, did we do a lot here when it comes to storage. Storage in and of itself is at least a three-hour conversation, and it pleases me to no end because we, like, knocked it out of the park. So we made investments when it comes to storage, both in file and in block. And we made some in Hyper-V, which apply to both. Your input on storage was quite simple. Look, number one, leverage my storage array capabilities. If I went out and spent 6-7 digits and bought this massive old SAN, please use it to its fullest. Okay? Tell me you can leverage that investment. Number two, I want native access to my SANs. So again, I've got this big old monster SQL server over here, and guess what? All of the data lives on my Fibre Channel SAN. My VMs need to access that Fibre Channel SAN natively with no trade-offs. All of the things that I do on my physical machine have to work in the VM. For example, MPIO. If you're a storage admin, if you're a SQL admin, if you're a server admin with your salt, you know that if you're going to deploy on a Fibre Channel SAN your massive scale-up SQL server, MPIO is absolutely on by default. You want to make sure that there's any, you want to make sure you have resiliency for your storage area network. So MPIO is going to be on default. Guest clustering, DSM software, that all has to just work. In addition, help reduce the cost of storage. What's interesting is, over and over again, you told us, you know what, I've got storage over here, I've got some storage over here, it's kind of siloed all over the place, it's very expensive, is there a better way we can manage this? Can you give us additional options to help us lower the cost of storage? This is a big one. And then finally, big data. Big data is here. Brad had some really great statistics this morning about how quickly storage is just exploding and data is growing everywhere. Well, Hyper-V and virtualization software has long been limited to 2 terabytes per virtual disk. That didn't seem like a big issue a few years ago. Now it's a very big issue because we're running into people saying, I got to create VMs with all sorts of virtual disks over here, and I really want to be able to, you know, keep it confined to one or just a couple. So big data is here. So the first thing we did was, like I mentioned before, we've done all this work in CPU, we've done all this work in memory, but if I don't keep those processors and memory busy, it really doesn't matter. So the first thing we did was we went back to the storage stack again and supercharged the Hyper-V IO stack. We can now deliver over 1 million IOPS from a single VM. What's interesting is whenever I point out that number, a lot of people can't even with any confidence understand what a million IOPS means. To give you an example, we don't have a workload at Microsoft that I've found yet that pushes a million IOPS. I found two databases within Microsoft, two monster databases pushing a 250,000 IOPS, and I found one even bigger that pushes about 400,000 IOPS. Haven't found a single thing within Microsoft that's pushing this level of scale yet. So with 64 virtual procs, with over a terabyte of memory per VM, and a million IOPS from a single VM, let me tell you something, we can virtualize whatever you got. I'm ready. I'm up to the challenge. I haven't seen a workload yet we can't virtualize in 2012. And it's not that Server 2008 R2 was any slouch either. We actually did 250,000 IOPS out of Server 2008 R2, but we weren't done yet. We wanted to do more, especially since we'd done so much more in terms of compute and memory. On top of that, we made some major enhancements to storage itself. Number one, live storage migration. So now your virtual machines can be running, but I can move the storage from direct attached to SAN or to my file server. All of this happens live. All can happen live, and it's all concurrent. Meaning I can have multiple live storage migrations happening simultaneously, limited only by the amount of hardware you want to provide to the party. So that's a big one. Number two, VHDX format. We have a new virtual disk format, really important. We love this thing so much, it's on by default. When you create a new VM in 2012, this is what we use. Now, if you still have your old virtual disks from 2008 and 2008 R2, no problem. We read them just fine. We can still create VHDs just fine. They work just great. But VHDX is about redefining the next generation of virtualized storage. Number one, up to 64 terabytes per virtual disk. That's not a typo. That's not per VM. That's per disk. And we support up to 255 disks per VM. So if you do the math, that's roughly 16 petabytes of storage per VM. You're going to run out of physical storage long before you run out of virtual storage. We now auto-align with your SANs. So if you're using your NetApp, you're using your EMC, basically it's a no-brainer. We automatically do the right thing for your SANs and auto-align. So any disk alignment issues that you may have seen or run into or heard about or were rumored to have heard about in the past, they're all gone. VHDX just automatically does the right thing. Major performance improvements, which I'll get to in a second. Native support for the new 4K disks coming out. So those are starting to come out to the market. We've had 512E drives for quite a while, which are actually 4K on the back end, but pretend to be 512 on the front. We're starting to get to 4K native. Server 2012 is the first version of Windows Server to support 4K native. By the way, the other guys don't support 4K native. So there, if you are one of those other guys' users, they're going to likely require you to pull out the checkbook to get an upgrade to support that, whereas we just put it in the box. Online meta operations. So if you use snapshots, you can now merge snapshots, take snapshots, all live. No downtime. In the past, if you wanted to merge snapshots, we needed to take a VM down. Now it's all live. So those are some work we did in the general Hyper-V stack, the virtual disk stack. On the block side of the house, so if you use Fibre Channel, if you use iSCSI, we made some huge investments here. Virtual Fibre Channel in the VM. Let me be very clear here. We spent a lot of time to make sure we did it the right way, and I'll explain what that means in a second. Offloaded data transfer. This is about leveraging the capabilities of your SAN in Hyper-V and in Windows Server 2012. Trim and unmap. This, to me, is probably one of the biggest gold mines that we have in Server 2012, and we haven't really said much about it. So let me explain to you why this is such an important feature. Say, for example, you got a virtual machine running, and that virtual machine has a 60 gigabyte virtual disk. You're running inside the virtual machine, and inside, you delete 20 gigabytes. Okay? So inside the VM, you just deleted a 20 gigabyte file. What happens to the underlying SAN? What happens to the underlying storage? Answer, nothing. Your storage has no idea that you just deleted 20 gigabytes. There's no notification, nothing happens, they are completely separate and isolated. So even though you just deleted 20 gigabytes out of the middle, and what you really would like it to do is to shrink and reclaim that, nothing happens. Not with Server 2012 Hyper-V. With Server 2012 Hyper-V, you delete that 20 gigabyte file, and guess what? We notify the underlying file system, the file system notifies the underlying SAN, and your SAN knows, oh, that 20 gigabytes is gone. I can go reclaim it now. Now your SAN can use your storage most efficiently. It can reclaim that storage, and it's fully automatic. You don't need to do anything. There's no reclaim storage button. It's all part of Trimmin on Map. This is gold, if there ever was one. No other hypervisor has this capability. This is all built into Server 2012. And then finally, support for VMs on file servers. With the new Windows Server 2012 file server and taking advantage of all the new enhancements in SMB and spaces. And I'll get to that in a second. So, file system availability. One thing that I get asked is, Jeff, I see you support 64 terabytes for virtual disk. Well, what happens if I have to run check disk on that? Because in the past, even running check disk on a multi-terabyte volume, 4 terabytes, could take a really, really long time. Very good point. Absolutely very good point. Except that we completely changed that in Server 2012. Because now we've gone from hours to seconds. See, what we did was we took the disk scanning process and separated it from the repair process. What this means is we can do online volume scanning. The volume is only offline to repair. And it's based on the number of errors that you need to fix rather than the total number of files on disk. That is the key to this. What that means is in Server 2008, if I had 100 million files, it could literally take me 109 minutes to scan the whole thing. If I had 300 million files, you're talking 376 minutes of downtime. Notice with Server 2012, the number stays the same. It's a fraction of the time. It's less than 3 seconds to scan 300 million files because it's no longer associated to the number of files. It's only associated to the number of files it needs to repair. So now all of a sudden, creating these virtual disks with 64 terabytes, not only does it make sense, but we got you covered here from a check disk standpoint. So we've thought about this end to end. From a performance standpoint, VHDX performance is way up. I told you the new VHDX format gives me greater capacity, but we also made some huge performance enhancements. So number one, what you're looking at here is VHDX performance of megabyte sequential writes. You can see here, much, much higher. What's actually not seeing here? For some reason, when that got transferred to the new format, it didn't work. The blue is VHD, and the green is VHDX. And what you're seeing here is a 25% performance improvement with VHDX. Now, some of you in the back or some of you guys that are storage architects may go, hey, Jeff, that's megabyte sequential. That's the easy stuff. And you know what? You'd be right. Megabyte sequential is the easy stuff. Here's the hard stuff. 32K random write. That's the really hard one. Well, if you can do this one, you're nailing it. Well, that's a huge 10% improvement on VHDX performance over VHD. And oh, by the way, sorry, I'll have to fix this before I'll repost the slides. This is native disk performance on the left. So let me go back 1 second. This gray one, that's the native physical disk. That is the absolute LUN speed of the disk itself. The blue is VHD. The green is VHDX. This is fixed disks. So you can see they're about equivalent because we're native speed for fixed. This is dynamic. And this is a differencing disk. So you can see for dynamic disks, we've gone up dramatically faster with VHDX. And with 32K random writes, again, you can see our dynamic VHDX performance is now approaching fixed disk native speed. What this means is you can use dynamic disks a lot more for a lot of those cases where people want thin provisioning, want the capabilities of thin provisioning, and the efficiency that dynamic disks give you. Virtual fiber channel. Boy, has this feature been well received. So again, you got the massive SQL server over here in the corner, and I need it to access my SAN. So inside the VM, we create a virtual fiber channel adapter. Just like you would on a physical machine where you see a fiber channel adapter in the OS, we create one in the VM itself. So guess what? That means things like guest clustering just works. MPIO software just works. DSM software, like you want to run EMC PowerPath, for example, just works. It uses NPIV functionality, which is technology that's been around quite a while and goes all the way back even to some of the earlier 2 gigabit fiber channel adapters. So it's been around a while. The support is for guests. It's Windows Server 2008 and later. And of course, this is a new feature of Server 2012. And of course, live migration just works. Because as I mentioned before, you guys told us no new features unless they work with live migration. So to that end, a couple things I want to point out. As I mentioned before, it works with NPIV. You get up to 4 virtual HBAs within a VM. And here is device. Here's what the device actually looks like in the VM settings. You just enable a fiber channel adapter. So you install the OS, and lo and behold, there's the fiber channel adapter inside there. You zone it and mask it just like you would a physical machine. I get asked this question all the time. Is there some sort of special magic? And then I found out the reason why people were asking me this question. The reason why people were asking me this question is because with VMware, there is all sorts of special magic you have to do to make this happen. Because they don't actually present a fiber channel adapter in the VM. You have to use their raw device mapping and all sorts of wacky things to make it work, which means you don't zone and mask it the same way you physical machine. And in fact, it means with VMware, MPIO doesn't work. It means guest clustering has all sorts of limitations. We don't have those problems. We didn't take any shortcuts. This is real, honest to goodness, fiber channel in your VM. It also means, from a live migration standpoint, one of the questions I get asked all the time is, how does this work then? How can you possibly live migrate and make fiber channel work? Well, let me actually explain this to you. So, when you configure fiber channel for a VM, you give it worldwide node names and worldwide port names, just like you would a physical machine. However, we have two sets of addresses. The reason why we have two sets of addresses is because as we live migrate the VM, there's going to be a point where we need to move the address, the virtual machine fiber channel storage to the new location. And the only way you can do that is to actually make sure that you present the target in both, it's zoned and masked in both the source and destination at the same time. Otherwise, you will have a drop in connectivity. So the way this works is it's worldwide port name A and B. We create a temporary VM on the destination server. We connect temporary VM's host bus adapters to the worldwide port name B. We verify that both sides have connectivity. We go through a pre-flight check, just like we always do for live migration. We make sure that there's enough memory, there's enough CPU, there's enough storage. Everything that we need is as ample resources. Once we do that, we begin the migration. We copy the memory pages over. We make sure that we keep track of all of the pages that are changing. These are called dirty pages. We monitor those, and we make sure that those get copied over as well. Then when we finally have to move the fiber channel HP over there, we briefly brown or pause the source VM. We change the temporary VM to the permanent VM and start the I/O over here. We log out of the fiber channel fabric on the left-hand side, delete the source VM, and run it on the target. And one thing I always like to point out is at no time during live migration is your VM ever at risk. We always keep it running on the source until we know that we've copied over everything. Once we can copy it over and actually begin executing on the destination, that's when we delete it off the source. Because we have to make sure that if any time during live migration anything happens, someone walks up and pulls out the network cable, guess what? It just continues to run on the source machine. So, a couple of fiber channel tips. Number one, it requires Windows Server 2008 and later for the guest OS. I've had a couple of people say, hey, I'm trying to run this on 2003. Yep, doesn't work on 2003, nor will it ever work on 2003. By the way, this is my quick little plug. If you're still deploying 2003, stop it. What are you doing? You might as well take your money and put it in a fireplace. Because Server 2003 on a modern server is a colossal waste of resources. I'm going to be really transparent about this. 2003 has no idea how to deal with all the cores, all the memory, all the I/O, all the new hardware that's been out. You're running an OS that's over 10 years old. Please stop it. Okay? The other reason why we won't ever do virtual fiber channel for Server 2003, it's a completely different driver model. So we're not going to do it. Number two, verify that you have the latest firmwares and driver for the virtual fiber channel, for the fiber channel HBA, the physical HBA. So even though you may install Server 2012, it may recognize the fiber channel adapter and install the driver, assume that there's a newer one already waiting. Go to your fiber channel vendor and double check. Double check the firmware as well. Probably the most common problem we've seen so far is, guess what? Everybody upgraded their firmwares for 2012. So make sure you do that. Verify that NPIV is enabled on the fiber channel HBA and that it's enabled on the fiber channel switch port. You got to do them both. So NPIV, end port virtualization, is a feature that has to be enabled on both locations. I've seen a lot of people enable it on the HBA, but not realize that they have to enable it on the fiber channel switch port itself. And if you don't, you'll get this error that says something like virtual fiber channel fabric doesn't support NPIV. And people kind of scratch their head and go, what does that mean? So make sure it's on both locations. Zone on the fabric should include worldwide port names A and B. So you got to make sure it's got both A and B populated. The zone should not include the host because we don't need to. Okay? Again, we present an actual fiber channel adapter in the VM. So you want to mask it and zone it just like you would a physical machine. Finally, I want to point out that you may see an option called NPV. I love the storage guys. They come up with these crazy, wacky acronyms, and then they have to make them slightly different. NPIV and NPV are actually two different things. We don't care about NPV. The only one we care about is NPIV, so make sure that's the one enabled. Offloaded data transfer, another huge storage advancement in Server 2012. And we take advantage of this both for Hyper-V, but just Windows Server. And to me, this is one of those great features that, honestly, if you've got a SAN, Server 2012 is a no-brainer. And here's why. If you need to move 10 terabytes from one part of your storage to another part, the way that would work today is with Server 2008R2, you would read and write. You would read and write. The server would perform the copy. There'd be a whole bunch of CPU utilization. There'd be a whole bunch of memory utilization. And, of course, all of this over the storage fabric. That's how it used to work. In 2012, we go to the storage and say, do you support offloaded data transfer? Storage comes back and says, why, yes, I do. Great. Here's a secure token. Go perform the copy. So now your SAN does, oh, okay, I'm just going to go move this. And in fact, in many cases, it may not even need to move the data. It could literally be moving pointers. So moving 10 terabytes is something that can take hours or even days. It could be done in minutes or even seconds, because your SAN is optimized for this. So ODX is a capability you absolutely want to look for if you're getting ready to make a storage purchase. Offloaded data transfer, like I mentioned, it's something that is available in, it's something that Server 2012 uses. It's also something that Hyper-V just transparently uses. So one example is creating a fixed disk. When we create a fixed disk, like a 10 gigabyte fixed disk, we create a single file and we zero the whole thing out, 10 gigabytes. Okay? So I asked the storage guys, I said, can you give me kind of a comparison? How long does it take to create a 10 gigabyte fixed disk on a standard desktop machine? And they said, oh yeah, no problem. It takes about 3 minutes. And I said, okay, great. How long does that take on a system with ODX? And they said, oh, well, Jeff, here, watch this. By the way, don't blink or you'll miss it. Click, done. So something that took 3 minutes, done in less than half a second. That's how unbelievably mind-blowing fast ODX is. So when it comes to storage, just across the board, treasure trove of capabilities, whether it's live storage migration, whether it's ODX, whether it's the new virtual disk format, whether it's native 4K disk support, ODX, and much, much more. By the way, in case you're wondering, there's the SMB3 protocol. People just want to know more about ODX or the VHDX format. All publicly available, all documented right there. So, common storage question I get asked. Jeff, we're getting ready to make a new storage purchase. And we're looking at centralized storage. Maybe we'll buy NAS, maybe we'll buy SAN. What should I consider? What should I ask my storage vendors? And generally, you'll find that, you know, we like all of our storage vendors. But there are some features that you definitely want to look for. Number one, ODX. Like I just said, you buy a storage system that doesn't have ODX, and then you see an ODX system, you're going to go, why did I spend that money? You should absolutely look for ODX. If someone says, hey, I don't have ODX, but this system does, you want to take a look at that one. You really do. It's night and day. If you're looking at NAS or file-based, take a look at SMB. Insist on SMB3. If they say, oh, no, it's only SMB1, leave the room. That's a 20-year-old protocol. It's garbage. Okay? I'm not here to mince words today on this one. SMB1 is garbage. Okay? It's time for that to go away. SMB2 got a lot better than SMB1, but SMB3 is a completely different world. With SMB3, we're literally talking about rivaling and beating fiber channel performance. That's how good SMB3 is. And it's because of not only performance and not only scalability, but continuous availability. If a connection drops with SMB3, it's now continuous availability. We can transparently fail over to other nodes without you having to do anything to your applications without the applications even knowing that the failover occurred. It's completely transparent. It gives you continuous availability. It's something you really want. So the other thing you should consider is the Windows Server 2012 file server with Spaces. Windows Server 2012 file server has all those capabilities, including ODX. SMB3 is its native protocol. And when you couple it with Spaces, you've got something that rivals a whole bunch, rivals very expensive storage appliances. So one of the questions I get asked all the time is, Jeff, what is Spaces? What is storage virtualization? What do you guys mean by this Spaces thing? I'm not really sure I'm getting it. And so I've actually realized that this is a pretty big area of, huh. So I came up with this kind of cool slide to kind of explain this. So let's take a moment to talk about a storage appliance for just a moment. When you go out and buy a SAN, you go out and buy a storage appliance, what is it? Have you ever actually looked inside of one? What will you find? What's in a storage appliance? You'll find, some x86, x64 processors. Oh, that's interesting. You'll find memory. Okay. You'll find a whole bunch of network adapters. Oh, okay. And you'll find a whole bunch of PCI slots, most likely filled with storage HBAs, like SAS adapters, for example. Huh. Well, that kind of sounds familiar. That sure sounds like a server to me. All right, well, let's take a closer look. So here's my storage appliance. If you take a storage appliance and cut it in half, just virtually for a moment, pretend there's a front half and a back half. What's the back half of a SAN appliance? What does it do? What does it really do? Well, there's multiple physical interfaces in the back end of a SAN. SAS, usually. You pool those disks. You present LUNs. You mirror them. You stripe them, create parity. You do something, but you basically take a whole bunch of disks. You carve them up. You pool them, and you create LUNs. That back end is attached to a whole bunch of disks. Very often, it'll be SAS. Okay, so that's the back end. What's the front end? What does the front end of a SAN do? The front end presents interfaces. iSCSI, Fibre Channel, FCOE, NFS, SMB. Okay, so on top of this, they usually won't sell you one of these. They'll usually sell you two. Okay, and this is what a scale-out storage appliance does. Okay, let's demystify the SAN for just a moment. So why do they sell you two? Well, because if one goes down, then guess what? All your traffic just seamlessly goes to two. If you need to take one down because you need to do a firmware update, okay? Or if you need to take one down because it's just, you know, the power adapter went down or whatever, you've got redundancy. That makes sense. That's what a scale-out storage appliance does. And in fact, your servers connect to it. Seems pretty logical. Seems pretty reasonable. So how does this compare with what we're doing in Server 2012 and File Server? Well, that back end, that's Spaces. That's what Spaces is. Spaces is plug in a whole bunch of disks via JBOD, and guess what? We can take all those disks, we can pool all those disks, we can carve them up, we can do mirror, we can do parity, we can do simple, we can pool all of those and create disks. Okay? What's the front? The front's the file server. The file server is, guess what? SMB, NFS. Oh, those interface. Oh, okay. And guess what? You can deploy two of those in what we call the new scale-out file server. And in fact, you can go all the way to eight of these if you'd like. Does that make sense? I see a lot of people doing this for the first time. Good. So to kind of give you an idea, that's what we've been doing on the file side of the house, and we're just getting started. Don't forget that the file server includes thin provisioning. It includes deduplication. You saw in the keynote this morning, we added more disks to a space live, all hot. And we're going to continue to do more here. We're making some very heavy investments in file-based storage. Windows Server 2012 and SDN. So when it comes to software-defined networking, I've really enjoyed listening to the conversation going on in the industry for the last 12 to 18 months. Everyone's talking about software-defined networking like it is literally the greatest thing ever. Your children will be happier. Your car will get better gas mileage. Your mortgage rates will go down. It just is going to solve everything. Okay. So what is not only what is network virtualization, but there's actually a much more fundamental question, which is why network virtualization? And I thought we did a pretty good job explaining that in the keynote today, but one of the biggest reasons is network agility. You heard me talk about this at the very beginning of my session. I showed you the cloud with three parts to it. And I mentioned that, you know what, very often you're starting in the private, and maybe you want to move that to the public or to service provider. Well, to do that, you need network agility. You want the ability to take your network with you to the cloud. That's what network virtualization is all about. It's about doing exactly that. On top of that, you want to be able to do things like live migrate across physical subnets. This is how you do that. Without network virtualization, you can't do it. Because by definition, crossing a physical subnet means you're going to have a drop in connection. Breaking VLAN scalability limits. Now, for most customers, this isn't that big a deal. If you're a cloud service provider, this is a very big deal. If you're an enterprise customer, this is a very big deal. I was in Australia. I spoke to 12 large customers, military, finance, healthcare, banking. I asked them all the same question. How many VLANs do you have? 11 of them said hundreds. The 12th one couldn't tell me if it was hundreds or thousands. The problem, they told me, was simply managing this is a nightmare. Network virtualization is about easing that management. It's about separating the control plane and the data plane. It's about centralizing the management of that control plane and getting a hold of your networks. You heard Brad mention this earlier. Today in Azure, on a daily basis, we're making over 50,000 network changes a day. That's a crazy number. Do you think humans are involved in that? Oh, no way. One change alone could be catastrophic on anybody's network. What you want to do is define the networks, define your logical networks, define your policy, and apply and assign resources to them and let the fabric figure itself out. And you put that policy and that intelligence into the fabric itself. That's what network virtualization is about. And finally, it allows you to merge networks on the same fabric. For example, I spoke a few months ago with a customer who basically said, look, we've had some mergers and acquisitions. So I've got four different quote-unquote data centers that I need to somehow rationalize. And I'm thinking maybe I need to just bring in a guy with a PhD in networking to try and figure this all out. This actually solves this problem. We'll just virtualize the network, and even though they have the same IP addresses, even conflicting IP address ranges, conflicting subnets, it can all run on the same physical fabric because network virtualization gives you that logical segmentation. And I'm not going to go into the details because, like I said, I got 8 days of content in 75 minutes. If you want to know more about it, these are defined by public RFCs. So first of all, what we're doing with network virtualization is all industry standard. This is not some Microsoft proprietary thing. This is very much industry standard. And in fact, if you want to read all about it, there's the overview, there's the deep dive. It's all there. All the links are available. And let me tell you right now, the industry is really excited about this. And we're working with everybody. Finally, there's the extensible switch. So we look at software-defined networking as having two crucial components. One of them is network virtualization. The other one is the extensible switch itself. And there's a number of different ways you could do it. One is to create a replaceable switch. We certainly could have done that. We realized, though, we wanted to create more value in the switch itself. So we made it open and extensible. By that, I mean, for example, say I just want to capture traffic, monitor traffic as it goes across the virtual switch. Well, then you can create a capture extension. In fact, S-Flow by Inmon does exactly that. Maybe you want to do something much more interesting. You want to capture traffic. You want to inspect traffic. You want to drop packets. You want to filter packets. You want to insert packets. Use the Windows filtering platform. Five9 software has virtual firewall that plugs right into the Hyper-V switch. It's the ideal place to do intrusion detection and intrusion inspection because right there, all the bits are there. And the Windows filtering platform, guess what, was designed and architected for exactly this purpose. It's the perfect place to plug in. Then finally, we also, of course, have forwarding extensions. So if you're looking for the Cisco Nexus 1000V, if you're looking for OpenFlow, NEC released their programmable OpenFlow switch first for Hyper-V. It's available right now. And Cisco's has been in public beta. You can download and be a part of that. And they're working like mad on it, and it's looking awesome. And guess what? If you decide you'd like to use these in tandem, you can do that as well. So if you decide, you know what, I'd like to use the S-Flow along with the NEC OpenFlow, you can use them in tandem at the same time. Can't do that with the other guys. Finally, you may look at this and go, you know, Jeff, this looks really cool, but I have something that's totally unique to my infrastructure. I want to be able to do something, and I want to look and monitor for a specific packet sequence that nobody else cares about. Great. You can write your own. Write your own switch extension. In fact, you can write your own switch extension on Windows 8 client, because Windows 8 client includes Hyper-V, and then deploy it on server. And by the way, anything you do on client is fully compatible with server. So we got you covered there as well. Virtual switch overview, Endis filter drivers, as well as the Windows filtering platform docs are all there, in case you're interested. So when it comes to networking, we've done a tremendous amount of work here. Network quads, network metering, DMVQ, SRIOV, a lot of alphabet soup. Let me explain to you some of the important ones and why they're important. VMQ is a way for us to accelerate networking for virtual machines. So if you're looking at buying some new hardware, one of the things I tell people you should be looking for in your network cards is certainly support for VMQ. VMQ is a feature of the hardware NIC. Okay? If it's there, we'll take advantage of it. If it's not there, then fine, we'll do everything in software. But this accelerates things in Server 2012. It allows us to distribute incoming packets and much, much more efficiently, as well as avoid some copying that we would do in the switch. SRIOV is another acceleration technology, but it takes us to the next level. SRIOV, I'm going to go back to my big old SQL server for a minute. So remember, I had a big old SQL server with dozens of cores, hundreds of gigabytes of memory. It's attached to my SAN via fiber channel. Guess what? It probably has two 10 gigabit NICs in there, and they're probably teamed for LBFO, for load balancing and failover, because I need to get 20 gigabits in there. So question, how do you get 20 gigabits into a VM? Answer, you use SRIOV. SRIOV is single root I/O virtualization, and essentially what it means is we're taking a physical NIC and plugging it right into the VM. We're actually plugging a portion of the NIC right into the VM. So when you go into Device Manager, it actually sees, oh, this is a real NIC. It doesn't even say Microsoft NIC anymore. It says, oh, this is an Intel NIC or a Broadcom NIC. Now, it has to support SRIOV. And one of the biggest challenges with SRIOV is how do you make this work and, like I said, not break the live migration rule? That's actually one of the biggest challenges out there. Guess what? We're the only guys in the industry that do this. You want to be able to live migrate your virtual machines with SRIOV? Hyper-V 2012 is the only way to do it. And let me explain to you how it works. So, first of all, with an SRIOV physical NIC, like I said, we map a function into the virtual machine. Now, it means it doesn't go through the switch anymore. It's actually talking directly to the NIC, which has some pros and cons that I'll get to in a second. So, how do you do live migration with SRIOV? There's actually a tremendous amount of difficult engineering involved to make this happen. I'm going to kind of sum it up to you in about 30 seconds. Number one, you turn on IOV. You enable this on the virtual machine on the NIC. Actually, there's a checkbox. You say enable SRIOV. When we do that, we actually create a lightweight team. Now, I use team in quotes because you don't actually enable teaming software. This is something we do transparently in the virtual NIC. And what we do is we basically, okay, all network traffic is now going through the SRIOV NIC. So you're getting massive performance. We can get line rate performance in a VM. You got a single NIC, 10 gigabits. Absolutely can do it. You want a team, two of them, we can get you 20 gigabits in a single VM. So now it's running, and now I need to live migrate this VM. Whole bunch of challenges here. What happens if I need to live migrate this VM, but on the other side, the server I'm going to live migrate it to doesn't have an SRIOV NIC? What do you want us to do? Do you want us to present an error that says, sorry, you can't live migrate it? No, that doesn't work, because you don't want that. Okay, so we have to figure out how to deal with that. What happens if we're going to live migrate it to a machine that does have an SRIOV NIC, but doesn't have any more SRIOV resources available? Because there's a finite amount of SRIOV queues on the NIC. So I want to be able to move it, but do you want me to give you an error that says, sorry, there are no more SRIOV resources? No, we have to solve for that one too. There's a bunch of really difficult engineering challenges here. Well, the way you solve it is, when you do live migration, we break this quote-unquote lightweight team. While we're doing the live migration, all of the network traffic goes over the software NIC. So while we're doing the live migration, the traffic goes completely through the software NIC, and we perform the live migration. We migrate it as normal. When we then move it on to the new target machine, we basically go on over here, we reassign the virtual function and recreate the team. If, for whatever reason, there's not an IOV NIC over here, we still work. We'll just resort to the software path. Because there may be a lot of good reasons why you still need to move a virtual machine to a host that doesn't have SRIOV. So, for example, something catastrophic has happened, and you need to get those VMs off that host as fast as possible. The last thing you want to be seen is an error that says, sorry, you can't do that. So we make sure that live migration continues to work in all scenarios. All transparently, all for you. Pros and cons, or considerations, really. So people ask me, Jeff, SRIOV sounds really cool. Should I just use it everywhere? Well, actually, no. SRIOV, to me, is one of those things that I use for that mission-critical workload. If I've got something that needs, look, 10 gigabits plus into a VM, SRIOV is the way to go. But for most workloads out there, DVMQ is the way you want to go. Because DVMQ is going to easily get you up 7, 8, even up to closing in on 9 gigabits in a VM. So VMQ also means you get all the switch extensions because it is going through the virtual switch. So we can take advantage of all the new enhancements, all those extensions I talked about. If you're using SRIOV, you are making the conscious decision that you don't want to go through the switch. You're saying, no, I want to talk directly to this physical NIC, and that NIC is talking directly to some switch on my port on my switch. So you just have to take that into account, okay? SRIOV, like I mentioned here, is a checkbox. DVMQ, as I mentioned, a virtual machine queue at the very top, is a checkbox. By default, VMQ is just on. So if your hardware supports it, we'll take advantage of it. If it's not, we'll just fall back to software. Another thing I want to point out is another optimization, IPsec task offload. This is very important as we move to cloud, where all of a sudden now, who knows if that workload's running on-premises, or maybe I'm going to move it to a service provider. If I'm going to move it to a service provider, encryption becomes a lot more important. I want to do end-to-end encryption, and IPsec is a great way to do it. Now, in the past, with older versions of Hyper-V, we could do IPsec, but we'd have to do the processing in the VM. So we do the encryption and decryption in the VM. We can certainly do that, but it does add a little bit of CPU, a percentage point or two, when we're doing all that encryption and decryption. Well, if I've got dozens of these running, all of a sudden, that's additive. You don't want to be doing that all the time. With 2012, if your NIC supports IPsec task offload, we let that do all the hardware encryption and decryption for us. So you get that for free, too. And again, if it doesn't support it, then we just fall back to software the way we've always done it. And that's on by default as well. We also put in some security enhancements. So not only did we make their switch extensible, but we also wanted to provide the most feature-rich switch, even just using the out-of-the-box switch that's built into 2012. For example, DHCP guard and router guard. One of the things I like to point out to people is, look, the bad guys have credit cards too. Okay, there's no reason why I can't go up to Amazon, create my own VM and pretend to be a DHCP server, pretend to be a router, and try and spoof packets up there. Well, with this, we actually drop DHCP server advertisements and router advertisements, and you can enable that to give you an additional protection on the virtual switch. We also have port monitoring. So for example, if you want to do debugging, you actually want to monitor traffic going in and out of specific switch ports, you can do that as well. Bandwidth management, big one. So one of the things that's important is you want to be able to provide quality of service on a per virtual NIC basis to meet a service level agreement. So for example, even in a company, you may say, look, this is my SQL server. My SQL server is really important. Okay, maybe I'm going to give this half a gigabit NIC. It always gets at least 512 megabits. Great. On the other hand, those guys over in the marketing department and graphics department, they like to print out these huge posters on the plotter every week, and it consumes a lot of network bandwidth. So maybe I'm going to maximize them to 100 megabits. So even if they, try and send a huge old printer print job to the plotter, they only get 100 megabits. It may take them a little bit longer. Honestly, who cares? The important point is you can set that quality of service to meet your service level agreement. If you're a cloud service provider, this is how you make money. You have a bronze package. It means you get up to 10 megabits. You have a silver package. It means you get up to 25 megabits. You have a gold package. It gets you up to 50, and a platinum that gets you up to 100. This is how you enforce it. And that's on a per virtual NIC basis. Question from you. NIC teaming. That's also a cool new feature in Server 2012. We have in-the-box NIC teaming. So take a whole bunch of NICs, put them in there, go create a nice big load balance failover, it all just magically works, plugs right into the Hyper-V switch. One of the questions I get asked all the time is, can you mix different speed NICs? Like, I've got an old 100 megabit NIC lying around. Should I use that? Can I mix and match gigabit and 10? No. In fact, I even quoted it directly. Teaming of NICs with different speeds isn't supported. Okay? If you want to put a whole bunch of gigabit NICs in there, go to town. If you want to mix and match gigabit and 10 gigabit, that's fine. Just don't create teams that cross the two. Okay? And from a networking standpoint, it's all there and much, much more. So, storage and VDI. One of the things I get asked about all the time is, how do you do sizing for VDI storage? And there's something I've noticed time and time again. People are doing VDI storage, and they're looking at the wrong metrics. So I thought today we'd actually walk through a scenario end-to-end to understand this. One of the things I want to point out is virtualization bottlenecks. So I talked to you about all the work we did in compute, talked to you about all the work we did in memory, and in networking and storage. Okay? 99 times out of 100, Hyper-V is waiting for your storage. It's waiting for I.O. People always ask me, Jeff, should I buy the 2.4 gigahertz processors or the 2.8 gigahertz processors? Honestly, CPU is not my bottleneck. Hasn't been my bottleneck for a very, very long time. Memory is usually not my bottleneck. Most of the time, I'm waiting for the storage to get back to me and give me something to do. All right? So, with that in mind, it all starts with IOPS. So, a 15K SAS disk, okay, nice high-end 15K SAS disk, usually gets you anywhere between 150 to 200 IOPS per disk. So I shot right in the middle and said 180. So it means two disks gets you 360, 10 gets you 1800, 100 gets you that. All right? Now suppose you're trying to deliver this for hosted desktops. Let's kind of walk through this scenario. So this bank has over 500 Windows desktops they want to deploy. Each user is going to get 60 gigabytes of storage, and the SLA per user is 10 IOPS. So assuming you're going 2 terabyte 15K disks, 30 terabytes of capacity is required, and 15 disks can give you that capacity. This is usually where everyone stops and makes the big mistake. They go, oh, I only need 15 disks. Nope, no, you don't. That's actually very, very wrong. You're sizing the wrong thing. You're sizing capacity. What you need to be sizing is IOPS. Let's take a look at the IOPS for just a moment. You actually need 5,000 IOPS. So it means you'd need at least 28 disks to give you those required IOPS. Wow, I'm off by a factor of 2. And guess what? You didn't include any RAID overhead. So there's going to be a little over there. So you're going to want to smidge more than that, which is going to inflate the numbers further. So everyone's been looking at capacity and not looking at IOPS. So some of the challenges for this are bootstorms. Okay? Guess what? Everybody comes in at 9 a.m., fires up their VMs, and guess what? Now we're just taxing the heck out of the storage. So VDI pool desktop deployment is a common stateless image used by multiple people. Profile data is stored somewhere else, like on a file server, or use application virtualization to virtualize the applications, while the OS writes the differencing disks. SANs will usually help this out by putting flash in there. Okay, they can throw some money at the problem, and you know, you can buy this as an option. And it gives you more IOPS, but you got to pay more for the RAM or flash. The goal here is you want to increase IOPS, and you want to decrease latency by providing an integrated storage caching solution on commodity mainstream storage. So what did we do in Server 2012? Again, this is one of those really cool features that you probably haven't heard much about. It's the Cluster Shared Volume Cache, the CSV cache. What this means is we actually take system memory, just good old memory in the system, and we make that a cache for storage. It provides caching for read-only unbuffered I.O., and it's integrated right into failover clustering. This is best for read-heavy workloads. All right? So let me show you the proof. Here's the test we ran. 32-node cluster, 200 VMs on each node. So we didn't do some little, you know, minor little test. This is a big one. 32 nodes, 200 VMs on a node, each VM running Windows 7, all VMs cleanly shut down. We then turn them on. You can see without the cache, wow. Look at the read queue time over during the boot. You can see storage is completely bottlenecked. Cannot get enough. Look at what the CSV cache did. We've actually got a number of different ones, 512, 2 gig, and 4 gig, and I'll get to that in a moment. The goal here was to compare with and without the CSV cache to see just how efficient it was. Very efficient, in fact. So we then ran the same test, this time getting rid of the physical disk. We wanted to test the different cache sizes. So should we be using 512? Should we be using 2 gigabytes? Should we be using 4 gigabytes? And what we found out is actually 512 is the sweet spot. 2 gigabytes, 4 gigabytes, we're kind of getting to diminishing returns, which is very nice. 512 gigabytes of memory isn't that much. So the outcome is that the CSV cache is recommended by default to use 512 megabytes of memory. And this test demonstrated, that's right, 1661 percentage performance improvement just by using the CSV cache. So this is just using good old main memory, taking advantage of this capability built in the cluster shared volumes to dramatically improve your IOP, read IOP performance in Server 2012. And again, just want to point out something. CSV is a read cache, okay? Now, one of the nice benefits of this, writes are not cached because we want to make sure that if we commit a write, it goes all the way down to storage. Okay, that's in case there's a power outage. Okay, that's for your safety. But we've actually seen cases where this actually helps performance on writes as well. And the reason why is because so much data is coming out of the read cache that the disks have more free time to actually perform the writes. So it's an indirect benefit. Okay, I'm not promising you any write performance improvements, but we have definitely seen it. So it can happen. High availability. So your input on HA, just going to double check my time here. Good. When it comes to HA availability, VMs need access to fiber channel SANs. We already covered that with virtual fiber channel. What about legacy apps that support clustering, that don't support clustering? Is there a way you can give me an HA solution that helps those situations out as well? Can you ease my integration with SANs, replication, snapshots? Can you just make it all work? And again, I talked about highly scalable virtual disks. So there's a number of things that enhancements we made to clustering and CSV 2.0 in Server 2012. One of them is cluster shared volumes now just work with your out-of-the-box SAN replication. So in the past, there was some special magic that needed to make that work, still making the intermediate filter storage drivers work with cluster shared volumes. Now it just simply works out of the box. On top of that, we include VM failover prioritization. So when you set up your cluster and you've got a whole bunch of VMs, there's some VMs that are going to be much more important. For example, my Active Directory domain controller, yeah, that's really important. That's going to be high. Okay, I'm going to make sure that some things are going to be higher. SQL is going to be much higher. My print server, that's really low. Okay, that one, we'll get around to that one when it comes back up. So that's a nice one. Live migration queuing. So for example, if I want to live migrate a whole bunch of VMs, but I'm running really slow links, I got gigabit Ethernet. Okay, I don't have 10 gigabit or multiple NICs or anything, just use an old gigabit Ethernet. And I need to live migrate 50 VMs over, you can actually queue them. So it'll do two at a time, next two, to next time, next two, and it'll just do two at a time as opposed to sitting there and having to do them each one manually or trying to do 50 simultaneously over a gigabit. That would not be good. Okay, it'll take a really long time. So inbox queuing is there. And then finally, anti-affinity virtual machine rules. Now, this is great for scale-out applications. Exchange, for example. You do not want all of your DAGs on the same server. Anybody who runs Exchange knows, no, please don't do that. What you really want is to make sure that you're actually enforcing a policy where they don't reside on the same server in the case of a failover. Do exactly that. You can create anti-affinity rules, so if there is some sort of cluster outage, guess what? Those VMs still get dispersed across the nodes in the cluster. So, you're building a cloud. I get this question asked all the time. Jeff, what other safeguards can you do to help me protect the data? I hire really good admins. I do background checks. I've known these guys forever. I'm actually not worried about those guys doing something malicious. What I am worried about is the whoops moment. The, you know what, we accidentally had some data leakage out the side door and now we could be liable. Are there any tools that you could use to help me with that? One example is a HIPAA breach. This happened last year. This is a medical provider in Tennessee paying $1.5 million to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And in fact, they actually did a bunch of due diligence. They said, look, we shouldn't get fined anything. Because look, we got, and what actually was stolen was 57 hard drives were stolen with protected health information. Think about what's the most personal private data you can think of. For me, It's not even my health information. It would be my kids' health information. I got two daughters, and if like any of their confidential health information went out there, was out publicly, that'd just drive me up a wall. Okay? I think about them far more than myself. Well, imagine you're one of those million customers that just lost your data, your information on one of those 57 hard drives. Well, they said, look, we secured the data. It was secured by security patrols going around the buildings. It was secured by a biometric scanner to get in the building. On top of that, you needed a key card to get in. It had magnetic locks, and it had keyed locks. So they kind of said, look, we did our due diligence. We shouldn't be fined at all. Department of Health and Human Services, well, said exactly the opposite. We'd fine you more if we could, because the data got out. That's the point. So 71% of healthcare organizations have suffered at least one data breach within the last year. We want to make sure we're trying to put in helpful safeguards to help protect against this inadvertent data leakage, which is why we've included for the first time ever BitLocker encrypted cluster volumes in Server 2012. So in this case, you can now create the biggest, baddest clusters, 64 nodes, 8,000 VMs, but the clustered storage can actually be BitLockered for the first time. Up till 2008 R2, you could run BitLocker, but only on direct attached storage. Now you can cluster that storage and encrypt it as well. This all integrates with Hyper-V, it integrates with live migration, it integrates with Active Directory and group policy. So you get an end-to-end solution that helps your data. So even if a disk gets out in the wild, it's stolen, you plug it in, the only thing you can do is either format the disk or type in a PIN. That's it. You can't get to the data. So we're very excited about that capability. One question I get asked about clustering all the time is, how do I know if my cluster is validated and supported for failover clustering? And usually people that are asking me this question are thinking way back to like Server 2003. Because back in Server 2003, we had this rigorous, very formal validation process. It was actually very heavyweight. And in 2008, we actually fixed this many years ago, we actually built in a tool right into Windows Server. So the way this works now is, in Server 2008 and 2012, and in fact 2012 it's gotten even faster, there's a tool. You run the validation tool. It scans every node, scans your storage, scans all your storage interfaces, and it comes back and says, yes, you passed. If something doesn't pass, like, whoops, this one node can't see your shared storage, it'll tell you. Give you an error, say, no, you need to fix this, go rerun it. If you get all your green lights across the board, you pass validation, you have a supported cluster configuration. And I even included the KB articles for all of the different server versions there. Basically, it says exactly what I just told you. So when it comes to redundancy, we've got it from the bare metal all the way up. We've got hardware errors that can be tracked with WIA, Windows Hardware Error Architecture, and RAS. We've got live migration for planned downtime. We've got failover clustering for unplanned downtime. So if I walk up to a server, yank out the power cable, those VMs will automatically fail over to other nodes without any user intervention. If you go up a level and look at I/O redundancy, we got you covered there. We got MPIO for storage redundancy. We've got multipath I/O, we've got multi-channel SMB if you're using SMB to the file server. We've got NIC teaming, LBFO, and it's active-active, by the way. So we got you covered from an I/O perspective. If we go up the stack even further, we have application service failover within the VM. So for example, you can guest cluster your VMs. You can use that via iSCSI, or you can take advantage of the new virtual fiber channel capabilities built into 2012. We also can do guest NIC teaming of SRIOV. No other vendor can do this. So again, I can take that workload that was running on a physical machine, put it in a virtual machine without any trade-offs. I get virtual fiber channel with MPIO. I can use two SRIOV NICs teamed to get me 20 gigabits into a virtual machine, all redundant with LBFO, fully supported by us. You go up the stack even further, we also have disaster recovery with Hyper-V replica, which I'll get to in a second, as well as cluster shared volume integration with storage arrays and synchronous replication. So you look, the entire stack, from the hardware down all the way up and even out of your racks, you have complete replication in the path. So VM mobility, something you told us you really, really love. We agree with you. Live migration with HA, we've had that in the box for a while now. Now it's concurrent. We've got SMB live migration. We've got live storage migration. So we've got all different types of live migration in there. When it comes to concurrent, I mentioned before that we're only limited by hardware resources. So I couldn't fit my hardware in my carry-on, so I thought I'd show you what 40 VMs live migrating simultaneously looks like. This is right here in one of our machines in the test lab. You can see I've got 40 VMs. And what, by the way, just in case you're wondering why this little window here is, this is just, we just automated it through PowerShell, because actually walking through in each one of them trying to live migrate them manually through the UI, it would take longer, and we'd actually couldn't do all 40 simultaneously through the UI, so we just triggered it through PowerShell. And what you're seeing here is this is actually two 10 gigabit NICs. So we're doing two 10 teamed LBFO NICs, and we're live migrating 40 VMs simultaneously to Server 2012. Nothing special. This is all commodity, mainstream hardware, and it simply just works. So again, the whole goal here is to future-proof you. If today you're using gigabit, we'll support it great. If you're using 10, we got you covered. If you got dual 10, we still got you covered. Down the road, when you move to 40 and even higher, guess what? Out of the box, we're still ready to do even more. That's how prepared we are with Server 2012. So we've got live migration with HA, we've got SMB live migration, we've got live storage migration, and of course, my favorite, shared nothing live migration. So shared nothing live migration is literally two servers with nothing but an Ethernet cable. No shared storage, no SANs, no file, literally nothing but two machines. All I have am using is Ethernet. And to quickly walk you through that, because I get asked this all the time, I put this in the slide so it'd be really easy. You guys could take a look at it when you take them home. But you literally right-click on a VM and say move. Then it asks you what type of move is this. Am I going to move the virtual machine or move the virtual machine storage? The second one is live storage migration. The top one is live migration. Now it asks me, hey, what's the name of the server I'm going to move it to? Now you can see I've got a number of different options. Am I going to move the virtual machine to a single location? Do I want to move it to a number of different locations simultaneously? For example, if I had multiple virtual disks, I could actually move three different virtual disks to three different locations all simultaneously through live migration. No one gives you that level of granularity. This is all built into 2012. In this case, I just want to move the entire VM. I provide a location, and that's it. I'm done. Now, if I'm using System Center Virtual Machine Manager, I don't even need to do that. I literally drag it and drop it. I take the VM. I say, hey, it's running on this host. Let's move it to this host. Done. If I can do a live migration with shared storage, it'll automatically do it. If I don't have shared storage, it'll just automatically use shared nothing live migration. So that gives you transparent, easy mobility for your VMs, all built in the Server 2012. And we are the first virtualization vendor to offer this capability. DR. So this is a capability that honestly has resonated with me for a very, very long time. I've been watching this, and I've been watching this for a long time, and it all started here with Hurricane Katrina. This is August 2005. And when Hurricane Katrina hit, the thing that to this day still rankles me is we knew this was coming. I grew up in California. We have earthquakes. Okay? There's no warning. It just starts rattling and you try and find a safe place to be. With Hurricane Katrina, we watched this for a week. We went home, we turned on the news, and we said, yeah, it's going around the south part of Florida. It's heading right into the Gulf of Mexico. Yep, we think it's going to hit New Orleans. In fact, we were only off by a couple hours, and yeah, there it was. Still, people lost everything. Everything. And I have to ask why. Okay? Disaster recovery technology has been around a very long time. So why aren't people using it? Well, there's a lot of different challenges. Number one, cost. If you set up DR today, I'm going to paint with a broad brush for a moment, DR generally means SAN on site one, SAN on site two, and big connectivity synchronous replication pipes in the middle. Very expensive. Number two, complexity. If you've ever tried to set up DR, you've got site one that maybe is running on 10.0.0.1, and site two that's running on 192.168. And guess what? This site no longer exists, and those applications and services need to come up on a new site. Oh, and all the network just needs to magically work. Wow. That's just the networking, by the way. That's just one part of the complexity. Inflexibility. This goes back to storage. So again, today to do DR, it means you buy SAN 1 over here and SAN 2 over here. Well, what if you don't have two SANs? Or what if these are branch offices and they just have direct attached storage with some file servers? And you can't afford to buy a SAN for every branch office. What if you're a school? This actually hit home for me. I was talking with two schools in the last 6 months. They told me basically the same story. One school in Florida and another school in Nebraska. one in Hurricane Alley, the other in Tornado Alley. And basically they said, look, we partnered with another school about 60 miles away, and a teacher will go on late on a Friday or a Saturday morning, they do a backup, and then they copy it from one school to the next. So the good news is we have really fast internet connectivity for our education. The bad news is that a teacher has to come in on their time off and go do this process manually. It blows my mind. We want to solve those types of problems. Finally, the last problem I want to point out is distance requirements. So it's one thing to say, hey, I'm going to do synchronous replication, because synchronous replication gets me about 150 kilometers. Okay, well, what if I want to go from Las Vegas to Texas, or Las Vegas to Chicago, or Las Vegas to Bangladesh or Hyderabad? You're not doing it with synchronous. So we see all these problems, and we wanted to really go out and target a solution for those, which is why we've delivered Hyper-V Replica. Hyper-V Replica is asynchronous, application-consistent virtual machine replication built into Windows Server 2012. The key thing is, this is all software. It works with any storage. This can literally be two laptops. Okay? I've got colleagues of mine that have done VM replication between their homes over a cable modem. The point here was we wanted to go after, you know, those scenarios where people have been dying to do disaster recovery, VM replication, and have been unable to due to the complexity and cost. This works with direct attach, it works with file, it works with SAN, whatever storage. If I can see my storage and I can write to my storage, I can replicate to it. It also integrates right into Hyper-V. So you right-click on a VM, you go configure replication, and you walk through a wizard. It's also volume shadow services aware. So when we take the snapshot, we call down into the VM and say, hey, by the way, if you're VSS aware, like, say, SQL, make me an application consistent snapshot that I'm going to go replicate. This all integrates with clustering. It all integrates with live migration. It all integrates with Hyper-V. And again, the key thing is it works with whatever storage you've got. I'm also thrilled to say that when we had our next disaster, we actually were able to help some folks out. This is Hurricane Sandy. Anybody remember this one? Katrina was the worst, and still is the worst. Hurricane Katrina, $110 billion in damage. Worst U.S. natural disaster in U.S. history. Sandy, right now, current estimates are about 60 to 70 billion. Yeah, I do watch this very closely. 60 to 70 billion. So, there's New Jersey back in 2009. This is all courtesy of the USGS. So the yellow line there is to give you an example. There's your target point. That's before Sandy. This is after Sandy. You can see a whole bunch of that coastline is gone. A whole bunch of that highway is gone. Homes are gone. That's what Sandy did. That's just one little small portion of New Jersey after Sandy. The day after Sandy hit, October 30th, I'm thrilled to say that a number of us received this email. Good morning. Hurricane Sandy hit our area badly. Many downed trees, even on my wife's car. Flooding and total power cuts everywhere. We are very grateful that everyone is well, and so are we. I now want to thank the Microsoft 2012 server team for giving businesses the new replica feature. Two of our clients, both whom cannot be without their IT infrastructure, were flooded entirely and might take 2 weeks, it actually took them longer, to get back into their businesses. At 7 p.m. last night, we failed over their entire domains to the replica site, and they've been able to continue their daily business with zero interruption. Windows Server 2012 saved their business. This is why I get up every morning. This is the kind of thing that really excites me. We want to make sure that everybody has the ability to take advantage of replication. It's built into the box. It works with any storage. It's part and parcel. Please deploy it. Please take advantage of it. It's all in there. And the step-by-step, you right-click on a VM. It tells you, where's the replica server? You can configure for Kerberos. You can configure for certificates. Kerberos is important if you own both ends of the pipe. So if I'm replicating, for example, from Microsoft to Microsoft, and it's all my network, then I can use that. If I want to replicate across the wide area network, across the internet, to a service provider, I'd use certificates. You notice we also include compression on by default. We save about 60 to 70% on average using network compression. You choose which virtual disks you want to compress. Choose the number of recovery points you want to keep. By default, we'll just use one, but maybe you'd like more than that. Maybe you'd like to choose four. then you can see it's going to require a little bit more storage, about 5 gigabytes. Maybe you want to move that up to 15 recovery points. Then we'll automatically recalculate the amount of storage needed so you know how much you need for this VM. And you notice we have VSS aware, so I can enable that if my workloads are VSS aware. I then determine the initial copy. I can do the initial copy all over the network. Or if I know I've got pretty thin pipes and I need to move a whole bunch of data, what I could do is I could send the initial copy using external media. What that means is I could basically copy it to a USB drive, FedEx it to my disaster recovery site. So instead of replicating, say, 60 gigabytes of data from site 1 to site 2, I actually copy it onto a USB disk or a Blu-ray or DVD, mail it, FedEx it to my location, and then I just need to do the differences. So we've thought about that as well. The other thing is you can start the initial replication, and you can even schedule it. So, for example, maybe people are in the office right now, but I'd like to start the initial replication on Friday after 5 when everyone's left, and I can take advantage of as much network connectivity as available. So we've thought about that as well. And just like that, that's how you configure replication. So you click on Finish, and lo and behold, you'll see up in Hyper-V Manager, it says we're sending the replication across. And then from then on, we replicate every 5 minutes, ongoing, continuously. We just do all the magic for you. And a couple questions I always get. Jeff, what happens if the network goes down? Like, say, it happened this morning. Well, no problem. Replica, it's tracking all these log files. We continue to replicate. We continue to track all those changes. When the network comes back up, we'll replicate and catch right back up. So it's all covered for you. It's easy to set up. It works with your current hardware. You don't need new hardware. Works with what you have right now, works with all of your servers, works with server, it's built into server 2012, and there are no guest dependencies. So for example, if you are running other OSs like Linux, guess what? I just gave you a replication solution for Linux for free. You're welcome. Finally, the question I always get asked, Jeff, this looks awesome. So I'm using the other guys. Can you help me convert? Not a problem. We've got a free Microsoft Virtual Machine Converter. There's actually two ways you can do it. We've got System Center, includes a virtual machine converter built into System Center VMM. But we also have a free virtual machine converter. It's a 4 megabyte download. It's tiny. Okay? You download this, and it converts not only the virtual disks, that's the easy part, converts the VMs themselves, the configuration. Oh, it has this much memory, this much processors, this how its networking is configured, etc. So it converts the virtual machine configuration, it uninstalls the VMware tools, and it installs the Hyper-V tools for you. Much more than just a simple disk converter. Simple disk converter is actually really easy. VMD decay to VHD is not a big deal. It's all the work that you have to do to maintain the configuration. And what's nice about it is, you know, you simply point it at an ESX server or vCenter server, you select the VMs, and it'll do the conversion. It'll convert to 2008 R2 or to 2012, of course. And this is a free download available right there. So, why Server 2012 Hyper-V for private cloud? I told you I had a lot of content, and I'm sorry if I've kind of stuck the fire hose on extremely hard right now going through this session. Like I said, I'm not even scratching the surface of what's new in Server 2012. That's how big a release this is. So why Hyper-V? Well, number one, quite simply, Microsoft workloads run best on Hyper-V. Brad talked about this earlier, and I'm going to say it again. That's all we test every single day. We build, we develop, we test, we tune, we optimize all Microsoft workloads on Microsoft Hyper-V. No one else can say that about their hypervisor. No one else offers the performance and scale that we do. It's all built in the package. It's all included, tested end-to-end. It's also, we believe so strongly in it, that's part of our common engineering criteria. So, for example, when we release new products, they make sure that they go test and they pass the common engineering criteria. Hyper-V support is part of the common engineering criteria within Microsoft. Also, we have deep integration and partnership within server itself. So let me give you two examples. One new feature in 2012 is the ability to clone domain controllers. Now, anybody who's ever tried to deploy domain controllers knows you would never do that with a domain controller. Because domain controllers do not like to be time-shifted. You start a domain controller, you stop a domain controller. You don't save-state them, you don't pause them, you don't hibernate them, you turn them on, you turn them off. Those are the rules of domain controllers, so say we all. But with 2012, Active Directory and Hyper-V worked together to introduce a new feature called the VM Generation ID. This allows us to actually notify Active Directory when VMs have come in and out of save states, which means we can clone domain controllers, and it's fully supported, and it just works. And we tested it end-to-end with Hyper-V. Another feature is the BitLocker discussion I had just a few moments ago. BitLocker cluster integration in Hyper-V means we can give you clustered encrypted storage that all just works end-to-end. So we continue to work and integrate among the teams within Windows Server to give you the best experience. Dynamics, Exchange, Link, SharePoint, SQL, Azure, they all recommend Hyper-V. Azure, that's what they use. That's what Azure is entirely run off, Hyper-V. It's the best supported platform for Microsoft workloads and a whole bunch of other things I mentioned earlier. So the largest VMs for mission critical, the largest scale, largest cluster, deep integration with hardware such as SRIOV, VMQ, as well as others. Best-in-class agility, open and extensible. For example, our virtual switch. You can write your own capabilities right into the switch. Software-defined networking. We are the only platform that includes software-defined networking in the box. The other guys had to go out and buy Nicira for $1.2 billion. A lot of people scratched their head and said, why did they do that? The reason why they did that is because they were a few years behind us. We already built this in the platform. It's already built into 2012. There isn't something else you have to go buy and add. Network virtualization is baked into the platform, and then it's managed via System Center. That's what end-to-end network virtualization looks like. Built-in replication. As I mentioned before, Replica, I'm extremely proud of this feature, and you're going to see us do even more innovation on this capabilities. Finally, you ask me this question all the time, so I just put the link in there. Everyone wants to know, okay, how does this compare to the other guys? Jeff, is this the release where Windows Server 2012 catches up to VMware? No. This is the release where we blow past them. They're trying to catch up to us right now. They do not include network virtualization. They do not include remote FX GPU capabilities in the VM. They do not include replica as unlimited replication with replica out of the box. That's something they want to charge you extra for. Okay? There's a whole bunch of capabilities that we include in Hyper-V and in System Center. This will give you a nice, nice breakdown of all of those capabilities. So with that, I want to say thank you very, very much. I hope you have a great time here at MMS. And if you have any questions, I'll be up here to answer any questions afterwards. Thank you very much.